This Raw Talk podcast is sponsored by our friends at Mortgage Express. We'd like to thank Alfonso Archuleta of Mortgage Express for supporting the music and ministry of M88. They're located at 3701 San Mateo Northeast at the corner of San Mateo and Comanche. Their phone number is 237-2460. It's the support of listeners and businesses like Alfonso Archuleta and Mortgage Express that makes the music and ministry of M88 possible. Thanks again to Mortgage Express and Alfonso Archuleta for sponsoring this episode of the Raw Talk podcast. Talk on M88. I'm your host, Yo. That's kind of what we're talking about tonight. We're going to talk a little bit about a redefining of evolution as we take a closer look at the controversy that's been stirred up recently by the movie Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed. Once again, our origins are at the forefront of an intense debate, and we're going to get into that here in just a moment. First, a couple things. Wanted to thank Alfonso Archuleta at Mortgage Express for sponsoring tonight's Raw Talk. They're located at 3701 San Mateo Northeast on the corner of San Mateo and Comanche. Their number 237-2460. Can't say enough how much we appreciate sponsors like Alfonso Archuleta and all the listeners and businesses that help support M88. So thank you very much, Alfonso Archuleta of Mortgage Express, for sponsoring tonight's Raw Talk. Also, wanted to remind you, this coming Friday, the M88 prom tickets are going fast. Get yours soon. Bibles Plus, Parchments, Chronicles, Mr. Tux on Eubank. Tickets are $25. $20 for groups of 10 or more online at m88.org. And all the proceeds benefit M88. All the fun's going to benefit you. So hope to see you there this Friday for the M88 prom. Well, without further delay, we're going to dive into tonight's conversation. Have a special guest joining me tonight, Kenneth Poppy. He is a biology teacher. He's a guy who's very familiar with what can happen when you say anything about intelligent design in any sort of academic setting. And he's very familiar with a lot of what the issues are that are raised by this movie, Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed. So, Ken, thank you so much for joining us tonight here on Raw Talk.
Yo, it's a pleasure to be with you guys.
I really appreciate it. And Ken actually just put out a book called Exposing Darwinism's Weakest Link. Very interesting book. And it's actually written well enough in simple terms that I could understand it and follow it. So that's always a good thing. It brings up a lot of important issues that I want to get in with you tonight, Ken. But first of all, why don't you tell everyone a little bit about yourself and some of your experiences with this intense debate about evolution and intelligent design?
Well, my background goes pretty deep in teaching mostly high school biology, and that's where students in public schools are most likely to get the biggest dose of evolutionary science. If you open the average 10th grade biology book, you see monkey to man and fish to amphibians and reptiles to lizards, and all these texts that really don't leave any room for anything other than natural processes, and they certainly exclude God. And I always had a difficulty with that, being a lifelong believer. I was really forced to teach things I knew had problems, but I was never allowed to talk about the problems. So when I got toward the end of my career, I wrote these two books, the other one called Reclaiming Science from Darwinism, trying to get a chance to air all my objections that I had to keep pretty much silent about for so many years.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the movie Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed, they talk a lot about people who are ostracized, who have their careers endangered, who are denied tenure, all for talking about this alternate theory known as intelligent design. What were your experiences with that type of stonewalling when it comes to saying, hey, look, why can't we take a look at something other than evolution?
Well, and as I look back on the people who are still supervising and running the educational system, they definitely don't want any competition to the Darwinian model. I think they fear any kind of references to anything other than natural processes, because even if by default they lead to God, it's something they don't want to get into. And when you look at the standards that almost every state has, it's an evolutionary curriculum only. But, you know, the evolutionary model is really full of holes, and intelligent design seeks to examine these holes without bringing in the complications of Scripture, which sometimes cause us to start fighting among ourselves. And if you're from intelligent design, you think the science enough is powerful to show that God is out there, and then hopefully people will go out and find him for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Now, I thought it was kind of interesting. I was doing a little bit of research, and I came across a Gallup poll that was done not too long ago, and it said that when asked the statement, what do they think about evolution, the idea that human beings developed over millions of years from less advanced forms of life, 53% of people polled believe that to be true. When asked about creationism, the idea that God created human beings pretty much the way we are now within the last 10,000 years, 66% believe that to be true. Now, here's the interesting thing about that. If you add those numbers up, you get more than 100%. So people are really kind of confused about this whole issue of our origins. And this movie in Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed, has just illustrated that even more as the intensity over this debate has just increased. Now, have you had a chance to see this movie Expelled, Ken? And if so, what did you think about it?
Well, I saw most of it, and I saw trailers of it. I was taking some furious notes, so I may have missed parts. But but I can guarantee you that the people interviewed in there and their stories are very commonplace. I don't think you have to look very far at all to find people who even dared mention some of the science that Darwinists don't like to talk about. I mean, if you talk about the Cambrian explosion, the sudden appearance of life that has no explanation, that alone can get you in trouble. And I think that's what's so interesting, is people are so afraid of examining the real evidence. You know, it's almost like a reversal of 30 years ago. I think if 30 years ago, if you were the more religious you tried to be, I think the more people thought you couldn't be scientific at the same time. And I think that's really flip-flopped. I think the harder you try to be a true Darwinist, the less scientific you have to be. That's where the evidence seems to be pointing.
Well, that's an interesting statement, because I know there's a lot of Darwinists, or people who believe in evolution, that would say, no, we are purely based on science, it's all absolutely objective. Actually, when I pointed out on a blog, and interestingly enough, this whole issue of intelligent design and evolution, the number one blogged about topic recently, more so than politics, than the economy, than the war in Iraq. A lot of people are just in a fervor over this. And I was actually called an intellectual fascist for some of my views on this particular topic, which I thought was fascinating because I had no idea I was intellectual. So I was actually pretty happy to hear that. It's like, oh, really? Intellectual? Wow. I've never been complimented in such a way. Thank you very much. I don't think that's exactly what they're trying to go for, but I felt pretty good about that. So, I mean, there's just a lot of touchy feelings about this. And that's the thing that I find very interesting. I don't know how you feel about this, Ken, but more often than not, this whole issue seems to boil down to people's feelings being hurt. Doesn't have anything to do with science, doesn't have anything to do with an objective analysis of the evidence. It just turns into kids shoving each other in the playground saying, is so, is not, is so, is not. And in the midst of all of it, I'm thinking, what happened to the scientists? Where'd these kids come from? I mean, how do you feel about how sometimes it just seems to turn into a bunch of name-calling?
Well, and I think that's unfortunate, because most of the folks I know in intelligent design really have no problem with teaching the evolutionary model, because people like me believe the more you really understand what evolution tries to portray, the more the weaknesses boil to the surface. And I myself never had a problem with teaching kids how the Darwinists argued. It's a major theory of the 20th century, not the 21st century. But really, when you start to understand what the Darwinists really say happened, what they believe in their minds took place over time, then the weaknesses boil forth. So I have no trouble at all teaching the model, just as long as you get to talk about the weaknesses. That's the missing part as far as I'm concerned.
Now, why do you think it is that the evolutionary model, I don't know if you remember, but earlier this year, you know, the National Academy of Sciences put out a statement saying, well, the evidence for evolution is overwhelming and compelling. There's really no need to debate this issue anymore. I don't know if they knew this movie was coming out or not, but they tried to seal it off pretty quickly earlier this year. No need to debate it anymore. It's pretty much as close to fact as you can get into science. So let's all move on. And they're very kind about it, you know, like, hey, there's room for religion in science. Science doesn't negate religion, but just as long as we all accept that this is fact, and then we can move on. And they're all really kind about it. Why do you think it is that the evolutionary theory is so intensely protected from any sort of scrutiny?
Well, you know, I believe it's because the weaknesses are glaringly obvious. And the minute you are allowed to speak of the scientific weaknesses, Darwinism, then I think they fear having to give answers. I was talking with a group of students the other day about the giraffe with his beautiful 8-foot neck, and even from the Darwinian arguments, the closest thing to a giraffe neck is a 2-foot ancestor, and you've got to add 6 foot of neck to that animal, plus all these different subsystems, higher blood pressure, smaller capillaries. I mean, you're talking about a wholesale rewrite of some kind of antelope. There's nothing in the fossil record to support it, and even the paleontologists who dig up bones say there's really no good explanation for the giraffe. And ask that question. I'm not sure why. You're not allowed to ask it.
Yeah, and I think that's unfortunate because one of my favorite things, just as my own personality, is I enjoy asking questions. And, you know, we don't have the same viewpoints, all the better, because then at least we can have an intelligent discussion. But even in my experiences in college, that just wasn't allowed when I would ask certain questions of my astronomy professor or my biology professor. You know, I got slapped down pretty severely for bringing up any sort of question, which I thought was curious because I thought the whole point of being in college was to ask questions and to learn. But they didn't want me to learn. They just wanted me to be indoctrinated by, you know, whatever they were teaching, which I thought was unfortunate. And so I just was branded a troublemaker, which I thought was kind of interesting because I'm a pastor's kid. I'm supposed to be the good kid. Anyway, 505-338-5790. If anyone has a question about this, the evolution intelligent design debate, and we'll also discuss creationism here in just a bit. If you got questions, 505-338-5790, questions, comments, here's a good time to get those questions answered, get some confusion cleared up, because this is something, like I pointed out, that people are confused about. When you have a poll where there's more than 100% in the poll findings, obviously there's some confusion, so let's get that cleared up. 505-338-5790, if you got a question or comment that you'd like to share tonight. Now, one of the things I found really fascinating about how you approach this whole evolution, what are the weakest links of Darwin's theory, was how you, in your book, were saying that you can't explain the development of people without also explaining their morality and their spiritual side. It's not just enough to examine the physical. You also have to examine the moral side of it. Why did you come to that conclusion?
Well, and the weakest link that my book talks about, I truly believe, is the monkey-to-man theory as a separate piece of the total Darwinian package. First of all, I try to point out at length that the fossil record does not sequence itself like it's always showed in textbooks. We've all seen those great cartoons of the monkey that's a little bit bigger, and then he's carrying a spear, and then he's standing up, and then maybe sitting in a computer or something like that.
Yeah.
those are all over the place, and yet it's a very fraudulent representation of what the bones actually say to the actual experts, who bemoan constantly the fact that you cannot sequence them. In fact, the more they find, the more confusing the puzzle gets, and that's from the people who actually do the research. But on beyond that, you still have to explain the light-year advance that a Homo sapien has over something like a chimpanzee with our language, our morals, our information. We have taken leaps that really cannot be explained in the Darwinian model.
Yeah, and I like the fact that you pointed that out, because it's one angle I hadn't really considered, because, and I don't know why this is the case, maybe you can explain it to me, I was always told that those are the issues for philosophy and that really have nothing to do with science. If you're concerned about the morals of human nature, about whether or not we have a soul, well, that's for the philosophy class down the hall, not something to be considered in biology. All we're concerned about in biology is physical development. why are people so concerned about separating the two when, as you, I think, rightly pointed out, they really can't be looked at separately?
Well, I would counter-argue that the Darwinian model is highly philosophic. They imagine things that the fossil record doesn't back up, and in fact, if you read the latter chapters of my book, I look at some of the true Darwinists who try to explain how they think life developed, and they really result into something called historical narratives, which they make up stories as they go along, such as when the trees went away in the savanna, the monkeys were forced to walk on their hind feet, and suddenly they started to get taller and become humans. This kind of reasoning may sound unscientific, but people need to realize if you're going to lose your tail, you need a genetic write-up of your chromosomes. And that's highly scientific, but how does that happen through accident? Mm. How do we add all these wonderful pieces to the things we do? The Darwinians commonly refer to things like lightning and radiation as what scrambles our chromosomes for the better, but that goes against all the laws of physics.
Mm. Well, we have Mark on the line. Mark, welcome to Raw Talk. And what do you have to say tonight, Mark?
Hey, it's good to be on. I just had a question that, you know, I've had a good amount of formal training and science and things of that nature. And one of the things that has always kind of bothered me, and I love the Lord, and I want to align with his word, but the fact that they use carbon dating to date things that are very old, like dinosaur bones and things, and they say that these are millions of years old without any doubt, but that kind of goes against the creationist view, and I was wondering what you'd have to say about that.
Yeah, Ken, how would you respond to that?
Well, Mark, first of all, carbon dating cannot go back to the dinosaur times with a half-life of only 5,730 years. It might be good for a wooden axe handle or something like that, but when you start taking a half of a half of a half back to 60 million years, the results really become unpredictable. And one thing all people need to realize about radiometric dating is it's based on the supposition that the concentrations in the atmosphere have been the same for these millions of years they talk about. Well, nobody was taking measurements a million years ago to know whether carbon-14 had the same concentration because it's all built on a very static model. And so there's a lot of objections you can raise to that.
Okay, yeah, I appreciate it. I didn't think about the...
Are you still there, Mark?
I think we lost Mark.
I think we did. Well, I'm glad you pointed that out because it's true. There's a lot of problems when it comes to a lot of the dating methods, and there's even a lot of circular reasoning when it comes to some of the dating methods that are used for, you know, proving that the Earth is this many years old or that the dinosaur is that many years old and so on and so forth, which is all very fascinating. And it's something that has a lot of people concerned. Now, let me ask you, Ken, I don't know where you stand on this, but I'm just kind of curious. What's your view on how old the Earth actually is?
Well, I spend a good deal of time in the book discussing that, and I am a little more flexible on the term day than mm-hmm. some other people. It's yom in the ancient Hebrew, and yom is actually a pretty versatile word. Sometimes it does mean 24 hours, and sometimes, such as in the case of Rachel's grave is there to this day, it's the same word yom that's used in Genesis chapter 1, and of course her grave has been there for thousands of years. It's also the same word that Joshua used when he told the people at the banks of the Jordan, choose ye this day whom you will serve. You know, he wanted an instant answer. So I'm a little bit more flexible on the six-day interpretation, and also reminding people that God didn't make the sun, moon, and stars until day four, and those are our timekeeping devices. So I'm a little flexible in letting God work in his time frame, but what I try to remind people in my book is if God employed any of the scientific methods that the Darwinists commandeered, they're still his science. He gets all the credit.
Hmm. And that's a great point, and I'm sure it's not a point that a lot of Darwinists would like to have mentioned at all. Now, one of the parts of your book that I liked was when you went over some of the mathematical probabilities of having all the proper proteins create a string of amino acids, so on and so forth. And I thought that was interesting because, you know, one thing we're always taught is that if there's any sort of absolute anywhere in the world, it's math. You know, the right answer is always the right answer, and the wrong answer is always the wrong answer. It's immutable. You can't change it. And that's one of the beauties of math, is that there is absolute right and absolute wrong, which brings up some interesting points in and of itself. But I liked how you used that to kind of explain some probabilities. And the thing that occurred to me is, well, if this is how the math adds up, and I'll let you explain a little bit more about how you explain that in your book. If this is how the math adds up, why is there even so much of a debate? Because most people agree that math is pretty solid in its conclusions.
Well, I know several years ago the Darwinists talked about the we probably all remember Carl Sagan and his billions and billions of places out in the universe. His basic point was, if we have billions and billions of stars with possible billions and billions of planets, then life may be a statistic and not a miracle. And those are almost verbatim his words. But, you know, they don't use that argument anymore, because now what we know about molecular biology and what it takes to string these proteins together you were talking about, you're really drawing items out of a hat blind, of course, if there is no intelligence. And the numbers of organizing the highly specific proteins we need for our bodies so far outstrip the billions of stars in the universe that they don't usually use that argument anymore. One of the analogies I try to say is, how good do you think you'd do at solving a Rubik's Cube blindfolded? And that's nature's dilemma without God. To string these things together is just pull them out of a hat with no help.
I have enough trouble trying to do a Rubik's Cube with my eyes open.
Me too.
I have enough trouble trying to do a Rubik's Cube even when I'm pulling off the stickers and putting them in different places. I still can't pull it off. Yeah, well, it was really interesting because, you know, when I was reading about all the math, and, you know, I did something similar to your example in the book when I was taking an astronomy lab. You know, we were told to assign certain probabilities to how certain things could come about and then, you know, extrapolate that out with all the numbers of stars and possible planets and come up with a number of what's the possibility of life existing elsewhere on Earth. Well, I had limited understanding of just how rare it was for all the right elements to be here on Earth for life to exist. And I came up with a number that caused my astronomy professor to smile. He's like, well, that's pretty slim. And I said, well, that's what I think. I mean, when I think about how rare it is. And to his credit, that particular astronomy professor, you know, didn't slap me down right away. He said, you know, if that's how you want to do the math, if that's what, then that's fine, because, you know, I fulfilled the assignment. So he was actually a pretty fair professor, one of the few that I came across.
Right.
And, you know, as I explained him why I thought those things, you know, he was willing to accept my views on that, didn't agree with them. But I actually got well along with that professor because we could agree to disagree.
Sure.
But it was interesting to see you do the same thing. And, you know, again, if math is immutable, well, why is there so much of a debate? How do scientists write off the math as you presented it in your book? And there's so many different examples of it.
Well, I've heard them say, it's hard to win the lottery, but if you buy enough tickets, you're going to win. And I suppose that's true up to a point, but we're talking maybe 300 million tickets to win the lottery. When you get into the math probabilities of organizing these proteins, you're so far off the scale from anything in lotteries or the age of the Earth or the number of stars in the universe that really there's got to be a limit to probability somewhere. And intelligent design basically says blind luck. The universe is not big enough to hold all the probabilities of blind luck has to do the job, and I agree with that.
Well, we have Tara on the line next. Tara, welcome to Raw Talk. What do you have to say tonight, Tara?
I wonder why what they would say or defend that all monkeys, quote-unquote, didn't evolve into humans.
Yeah, that's a good point as well, Ken. You know, we hear all this stuff about monkeys evolved into humans and missing links and all that type of stuff. Well, if monkeys evolved into humans, why do we still have monkeys? I just watched Curious George today with a cute little monkey in it, and it didn't occur to me to ask that, but I was thinking, well, how come Curious George is still a monkey and he's not another man in the yellow hat?
Well, that's actually a pretty good question. You know, if I were a Darwinist, I'd probably say, well, there's a lot of old cars on the road that still run okay, and they still serve a function. And, you know, but the difficulty in that theory is we didn't get next year's model by adding one new piece each day for 365 days until we got our new 2008s. And that's a difficulty with a Darwinian model. The gaps between the species are unsolvable in any natural means. So if you're saying somehow a chimpanzee came from a monkey who lost its tail, then I think you should have maybe a monkey out there with half a tail or a fourth of a tail or three-fourths of a tail. And this is really what we're missing. It's like the species just seem to be here out of nowhere, and there's no connecting links to show that gradualism that Darwin thought was how it all worked.
Does that help you out, Tara?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for calling in. I appreciate your question. And if you have a question or a comment that you'd like to share tonight as we talk about intelligent design and evolution, give us a call, 505-338-5790. You know, again, there's a lot of confusion about this. So why not get your confusion cleared up if you're confused about it? Or if you have a conviction about it that you'd like to share, let us know what you're thinking about this issue, because a lot of people are thinking a lot about this issue of intelligent design, evolution, and creationism. 505-338-5790 to share your comment or if you have a question. And Ken, this is a, I don't know if this is a question that you've considered, but something that's been kind of bothering me, especially with the release of this intelligent design movie, I've been kind of wondering, what happened to creationism? Because, you know, the debate used to be, well, evolution and creationism. Should we have creation science in the school along with evolution? Can creation science be a theory that we use in the school along with evolutionary theory? So on and so forth. And now all of a sudden, especially with this movie Expelled, it seems like creationism has kind of been benched or something. And now it's intelligent design and evolution. Why do you think that's the case, Ken?
Well, I have a pretty strong opinion on that. You know, there's a lot of different religious views out there about how people think God made the world and the universe. And I just know in my experience, when I think about all the kids I've taught from all walks of life, it was like what you said earlier about they seem to believe in evolution and try to believe in God at the same time. So many people I bump into really believe in some form of God. They're passive believers and they're not exactly sure who this God is. But they also think that maybe some of the evolution that they study has some power of its own. You know, well, okay, God has some power, but maybe he used evolution to make things. And again, I go back to the comment that if God used any science, it's science that he designed himself, and so he still gets all the credit. But the difficulty when we try to get into religious interpretations and get away from the sciences, I think we often start fighting among ourselves about how we interpret certain scriptures. And when we do that, then I think we lose our audience. And I really think for these people who sort of believe in God but aren't sure if the Bible is really God's word, it's very difficult to try to quote the Bible to them to prove the Bible. And I actually think that's pretty fair. So what I try to do is just go to the hard science of how Darwinism doesn't work, and then hopefully they're left with no alternative but to go out and search for God for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you think about some of the confusion when it comes to intelligent design and creationism? I don't know if you noticed this when you're watching the movie Expelled, but and let me be clear, Expelled is not an explanation of what intelligent design is. It's more a cry for, hey, let's at least have some academic freedom so we can have more than one theory discussed. But one of the things I thought was interesting is that many of the evolutionary proponents, when they were asked about intelligent design, they equated it with creationism. It's like, oh, it's a creationism front. Oh, this is just another form of creationism. They didn't really see the separation between intelligent design and creationism. Why do you think that is, and how can we fix that? Should it be fixed?
Well, I would go back to the Constitution itself and what it actually says about freedom of speech. We're dealing with two things in the courts over this issue. We're dealing with something people call separation of church and state, which is not found in the original Constitution. That's just a judicial interpretation. But we are dealing with the separation factor that, you know, people don't want tax dollars spent on some religious movement, and the idea that you do have freedom of speech and can offer an alternative point of view from what the mainstream says. And I really think that intelligent design is the safest way to go, because without quoting Scripture and quoting God, if you stick with the science of it, these people may not like your science, but they just can't call it religion. So the common Darwinist tactic is to try to call intelligent design just warmed over creationism so they can dismiss it. But it's just not, if it's done right. Stick with the science and you don't run afoul of the courts.
You know, the interesting thing is that on the flip side, a lot of believers seem to think the same thing, that intelligent design is just another name for creationism. And you know, I've talked with some intelligent design proponents, and some of them have said that intelligent design would actually be better off so far as being taught in the schools if there wasn't so much push for it by Christians, by people who believe in creationism, because their support of it just muddies the water and makes people think that it is just a scientific cover for a religious movement. I mean, how do you feel about that side of the issue?
Well, I'd ask people just to read my book or many of the other good books out there on intelligent design. You will find very few scripture quotations. You find hard scientific objections to what the Darwinists say. And again, you may not like the science as it's explained, but you just can't call it religion. If I'm asking you to explain how a giraffe got an 8-foot neck from a 2-foot neck, I'm not asking for a religious interpretation. I want some good hard science, and that's not available, and neither is it in the monkey to man scenario.
Hmm. Well, we have Dominic on the line. Dominic, welcome to Raw Talk, and what do you have to say tonight, Dominic?
You know, I've had a question, because I am a believer, and like I was talking to my friend who's not, and one of his objections was saying, since like stars are millions of light years away, like there's no possibility of like young Earth. So I was wondering like what you have to say about that.
Well, I do have an interesting answer to that, but Ken, I'll let you go first. I don't know if that falls into your realm of expertise as a biology teacher, but do you have any thoughts about the whole starlight issue?
Well, I absolutely do. It's based on what we call the Doppler effect, that funny sound and the change of a motor when it goes by. It's really not changing pitch. It's just that the sound waves are being stretched out as it leaves, and they have used that to try to calculate the distance of stars. So I suppose it's possible that God could have made those stars as they were that distance away and then moving away. I suppose he also could have made dinosaur bones that just look like bones that never took a step. You know, that's part of the big debate about the age of the Earth. And again, I don't have any problem with an Earth that's in the millions of years old. I just have a problem with the Darwinian model that negates God's influence in the development over that time.
And, Dominic, you may be interested. There's a book out that's called Starlight and Time, which actually goes into very deeply a lot of the mathematics and a lot of the science involved with how stars could appear to be millions of light years away and yet have been created perhaps 10,000 years ago, according to a very literal creationist view from the Bible. So if you get a chance to check out that book, Starlight and Time, it'll give you an in-depth explanation of that, or at least a theory on that is it'll make your head swim, but it's very fascinating. So hopefully that'll help you out, Dominic.
All right, thanks a lot, man. I appreciate it.
You betcha. You have a good night. Next up, we have Jack on the line. And if you got a question or comment that you'd like to ask about this issue of intelligent design and evolution, you know, should intelligent design be considered along with evolution? Is evolution really fact? What should we do about it? If you got questions, if you got something that you'd like to clear up that's been confusing you about this issue, give us a call, 505-338-5790. And we have Jack on the line. Jack, welcome to Raw Talk. What do you have to say, Jack?
Hey, what's up?
Hey.
I had a question. Like, I've heard a lot about challenging the evolution theory, and a lot of it is fact to me. I mean, they've proven it, and I've seen someone actually talk about it on TBN one time and prove it to the fact where there was actually cover-ups who tried to make it believable, but it was proven wrong. And, yeah, I'm just wondering that even though there's all this proven fact that evolution doesn't exist, why are they still teaching it, or why are they still, like, using it as a way of means of explaining how life began?
Well, that's a very good question, Ken. If there are so many holes with the theory of evolution, with Darwinism, why are people clinging to it so desperately?
Well, I think it's a lot of turf protection. You know, if these people have been raised on this theory and they've invested their entire soul in it, if I can use that word, it's awful hard to recant when you get that far down the road. What they try to do is dismiss arguments like intelligent design as religious arguments so they don't have to face the gaps. And if they don't have to face the true scientific gaps, then I guess they can go on talking as if it actually happened this way. But there's one real good phrase that's often used. People have heard the phrase, seeing is believing. But with the Darwinists, I think it's believing is seeing. I think they go into the theory believing it's true, and then they see all these changes taken place, although the fossil record does not document them to any great extent.
You know, I once asked my dad, he was a pastor for a long, long time, one of the smartest guys I've ever known, still is a smart guy. No offense to you, Ken, I'm sure you're very smart, but my dad,
I've always
felt a little bit smart. But I asked him about that because of some of the issues I was having in college where, you know, I just couldn't get these professors to see things differently. They just didn't want to. They refused to. And I was asking him about that because I was really frustrated. And one of the explanations that he gave me, which you know, if it's all right. It's not super scientific, but I thought it was definitely food for thought. He pointed out that a lot of these people, their entire careers have been built around their support, their research, their publications of this theory of evolution. So if they have so much of their reputation, so much of their identity, so much of who they are is tied up with this, it would be extremely difficult for them to all of a sudden a student comes along and says something like, oh, you know what, I think you're right, and suddenly change.
True.
That just can't happen. As frustrating as that may be for so many of evolutionists, especially in academia, who they are is tied up with how they identify it with evolution. So in that sense, it's just not practical for them to all of a sudden say, nah, I'm not going to support this anymore, because basically, that would be losing their identity, which is something I never really thought about before. And after I did, I was much more compassionate when I, you know, would talk about these issues, because I finally understood that this person, a lot of who they were as a person, was tied up in this, and it can be a scary thing to suddenly lose some of who you are, and that is the case for a lot of people who support evolution. I mean, how do you feel about that, Kenneth? Is that like a fair explanation of how some people cling to this so desperately?
Well, you bet, and I think it's not only true from individual to individual, but I think it's true of the evolution movement in general. If you stop and think about it, can anybody bring forth any new, young, brilliant Darwinists that are taking evolutionary theories into new frontiers? Had a lot of famous names like Sagan and Gould and Asimov, but these people have already passed on, and other than maybe Richard Dawkins, there's no other major voice out there trying to make evolution stick. Because really, what scientists are having a hard time doing, and if I can use this phrase, the devil is in the details, that's where the problem is. They cannot begin to explain what we talked about earlier, how proteins can self-organize and how the Big Bang can ride this thin edge of safety all the way to completion. These are all scientific arguments for which no new Darwinists seem to have any more answers other than the standard fare.
Does that help you out at all there, Jack?
Oh, yeah. That explains a little bit more of it.
All right. Well, thanks so much for calling in, Jack. You have a great evening, all right?
Okay, thanks.
All right. And next up, we have Micah on the line. Micah, welcome to Raw Talk. What do you have to say, Micah?
I know we've been talking about the intelligent design, and I just had a question about the time scale that they talk about in, you know, evolutionary models. How would that fit into the design model of the intelligent design?
Did you get that, Ken?
I missed that, Micah. What was your, what, how did what fit in? I missed one key point there.
The millennial time scale, you know, they talk about all these different time periods and they had it all mapped out and all of that.
Right.
How would you divide up the time period that, say, on a 10,000-year scale?
Well, if you're talking about the geologic time scale and the Triassic period and the Jurassic period and so forth, again, I can go back that a lot of times, as Yo said, this is based on circular reasoning. They will tell you a fossil is this old because it's in this certain strata. And then when they find a fossil in that strata, they say, well, see, the strata is that old.
Mm-hmm.
And really, they use one to try to verify the other, and I think it leads to a lot of faulty science and a lot of mistakes.
So would you say that with a more intelligent design-based viewpoint, that a lot of those arbitrary separations of geological time periods kind of falls apart?
Well, I would probably say with intelligent design, they would argue that even with an older scenario, you have no chance for Darwinism to succeed. One of the most famous missing link in the world, people seem to know this, is the Archaeopteryx, this famous half-lizard, half-bird creature that they dug up in Germany.
Uh-huh.
You know, one of the problems with that, and this is the part of the science they never tell you, they've only found six of them, they've all been in Germany, and they're all exactly alike, and yet they have to bridge the gap between reptiles and some 24 different orders of birds, from hummingbirds to eagles to ostriches and so forth. So you've got one species in one little part of Germany that somehow has to account for birds worldwide. And it's a fair question to ask science how that works. And since there are no other intermediates to, I would think we would need a half-half, a three-fourths, a one-fourth, three-fourths, and so forth. The fossil record doesn't provide us that. And one of the tongue-in-cheek things I like to say is I try to imagine what it would be like if they dug up a platypus in the fossil record.
Yeah.
You know, you got an egg-laying mammal that looks like a beaver and a duck combination. I'm sure we'd have another famous missing link out there, but unfortunately that creature exists, and we know he doesn't change either.
Well, I hope that helps you out just a little bit there, Micah.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for calling in. And if you have a question that you'd like to ask about this intelligent design evolution debate that has intensified here recently, give us a call, 505-338-5790. That's 505-338-5790. If you have a question or comment that you'd like to share as we discuss intelligent design evolution and creationism here tonight. And Sandy's on the line. Sandy, welcome to Raw Talk. What are your thoughts?
Thank you. Our family just went to see the movie Expelled today,
mm-hmm.
and at the end where the interview where Ben was interviewing Richard Dawkins,
mm-hmm.
it seemed that Richard Dawkins went to, you know, it could be that super intelligent space aliens seeded the Earth,
mm-hmm.
and it almost seemed like he could go for intelligent design if it was super intelligent space aliens doing it,
mm-hmm.
as long as they had evolved according to the Darwinian theory, and I was wondering, did I hear that right? It's almost like he supported intelligent design if it was aliens and not, quote, God. Did I hear that right?
Well, I think you got it right on the nose. It's amazing how often a Darwinist, when backed in the corner, will suddenly transfer the origin of life out in the universe somewhere where it can't be studied.
Mm.
There are so many interesting alien theories. It almost sounds like they believe in a Johnny Appleseed kind of creature that, you know, travels around the universe, dropping a DNA molecule here and there and seeing what it develops. But, you know, that just begs the question of how life did develop out there. And I think it's one of the common Darwinist ploys, other than answering the hard scientific problems with their theory, is to just take it and move it somewhere else in the universe.
Well, and the other interesting thing is when you press them on that, you know, okay, well, you say it came from there. Well, where did that come from? Okay, you say that life came from there. Well, where did that come from? You know, at least the professors that I've debated with and talked with, eventually they get to a point where they stonewall and say, well, you're talking about infinite regression, and we're not interested in that because that becomes the realm of philosophy when you get into infinite regression. We're only interested in what is testable, measurable, observable, so on and so forth, and therefore you can only go back this far. And if you try to go back any further than that, well, then it gets into the realm of philosophy, and it's just infinite regression, and that's not a part of science, which I find interesting because I think you're right, Sandy. In the movie, when he was pressed, Dawkins did say, oh, well, yeah, maybe intelligent life elsewhere in the universe did it as long as they evolved according to blah, 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 blah. Well, you know, when I'm willing to bet, if you were to press him on that and, well, where did that come from, where did that come from, he would get to the point where he'd say, well, now you're dealing with infinite regression. That becomes a realm of philosophy and not science, which really doesn't answer anything. Does that help you out, Sandy?
Yes. I thought I heard that, but I wasn't sure.
No, you definitely heard that. And from some of the comments I've read recently, he isn't too happy about how some people are saying, see, Richard Dawkins believes intelligent design. and he has not been too pleased with that interpretation of his particular interview, and which is very... very interesting point. Thank you for bringing that up, Sandy.
Thanks, Sandy.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Have a good night. If you have a question or comment that you'd like to share, please do so. 505-338-5790. That's 505-338-5790 if you'd like to call in and share a question or a comment about this. Now, Ken, let me ask you this. I don't know if this is something that you've ever addressed in your classes when dealing with this issue, but you know, there's a lot of intense debate about this issue right now. And the question that occurs to me is, why does any of this matter? Why does it matter if we understand where our origins are from, be it evolution, intelligent design, creationism? What's the big deal?
Well, you know, going back to all the students I've taught over the years from all walks of life, most of the people I've run into, you'll believe, they do have a soul. I really run across very few hardcore atheists who believe that when you die, they put you in a hole in the ground, they cover you up with dirt, and it's been nice knowing you. Just about everybody I talk to believes that we have a component inside of us beyond mere biology that has a destination somewhere. And, then, of course, there's a lot of theories about what that destination might be. But I think that's what makes the issue of monkey to man most critical, because if we do indeed have a soul, then that assumes some kind of longevity, some kind of perhaps accountability, which brings in morals and things like that. I think that's why the atheists fight so hard against that concept, because they'd rather live their life according to their own code and not anybody else's. But as I point out in my book, if we truly have a spiritual factor, did our spirit evolve? Did we once have half a spirit? Or is there a better explanation for this side of us that likes art and music and does things like altruistic behaviors where we actually help other people that does not benefit ourselves? That totally breaks the Darwinian model. Humans behave in ways that animals never do. It's hard to explain that with some kind of scientific theory.
Yeah, and it doesn't seem like the scientific theories are all that concerned with why any of this matters. They're just concerned with their pet theories. In the few times that I've asked, well, why does it matter where we come from? Evolution doesn't seem to care about why it matters. All they seem to care about is whether or not it's fact or not. And I've always found that kind of interesting because my belief has been that people want meaning for their life. And evolution doesn't really provide that for us, does it?
Well, not in the least. If strict evolution is true, this is all some big random accident we're in. We're in this one little touch of reality between two great stretches of the unknown. And, you know, we're here as a blip and then we're gone. That'd be very depressing to have that kind of view of life, that there's nothing bigger than ourselves, and we're just in this dog-eat-dog struggle to get our 70 or 80 years worth in.
Now, how would you say this issue affects people on a daily basis? You know, we might all hear, okay, this movie Expelled is out, it's causing controversy. Richard Dawkins is out there with the God delusion, saying that, you know, God doesn't exist, and if he does, it's not someone I would ever want to know. And we hear that intense debate going on. And yes, it's very interesting, the two sides and how they present things, but does it really affect the average person in their daily lives? How does it affect us?
Well, if you have kids in the public school system, yo, I can guarantee you they come home with stories of bullying. They come home with stories of students who will say anything and do anything to achieve their own ends. And I think that's one of the really sad downfalls of Darwinism. If there truly is no code, no values, then who's to say what's right and wrong? And if you're a school administrator and you're not sure what's right and wrong either, then how can you take a step to do any kind of punishment? And it's very interesting that so many of our schools have to have anti-bully programs. And if you think about it, bullying is Darwinism in action. You know, it's the strongest guy picking on the weakest people. And if that's truly the philosophy that we all live by, well, you know, it just negates concepts like the Ten Commandments. And you don't have to have just the Ten Commandments. You can go to any moral code. And I think they're highly consistent around the world that certain things such as murder and stealing are just not right. Well, if the Darwinist model is true, how can anything be right or wrong?
Mm-hmm. And I've always thought it was interesting that this issue, be it intelligent design, evolution, or creationism, directly affects how we view God. And with intelligent design, I don't know how you feel about this, but how important is the identity of the designer in intelligent design?
Well, I think with most of the people I talk to in the field, they allow people to have their own interpretations. I know people in intelligent design that are Buddhists, that are Islamic. You know, it's just really the idea that there is a superior designer out there, and people have called God by different names, you know, throughout all time. Indians had a different name. Eskimos have a different name. I think it's man's attempt to try to put a handle on who this person is, and in my view, the Bible gives us the best picture of that.
And why would the identity of the designer even matter? I mean, if we're talking about science here, then that shouldn't really be an issue. But even in the movie Expelled, that identity was something that was constantly discussed. So, I mean, why is this identity of the designer an issue that keeps cropping up for both sides?
Well, it shouldn't crop up in the science class, in my opinion. I think you need to stick to the science, otherwise you get into religious squabbles. But if you're sitting down with a friend and you both agree you know there's something bigger than us around here, then I think it's perfectly right to try to seek out this entity and try to figure out who it is and what he expects of us. And, you know, personally, I think that's one of the things that scientists have a hard time with is bending their knee to anything because they're so used to believing that I can find the answer myself. I don't need God or anything else. And I think there's sometimes an arrogance that goes along with science instead of the humility, I think, is a more proper approach.
Well, Ken, we're just about out of time tonight, but to kind of wrap things up and put like a practical spin on all of this, what should the average person do about this issue of intelligent design, evolution, creationism, the origins of where we came from? You know, we talked a little bit about how this affects us. Well, then the question becomes, well, what should we do about it, especially as this debate continues about whether or not any of this should be allowed into the classroom?
Well, you know, I would encourage people out there to really study the science of Darwin's weaknesses. You know, it really is a scientific pursuit if you get into things like the Cambrian explosion and the self-organizing of proteins and the Big Bang. You're going to find many, many reasonable scientific objections that certainly under freedom of speech you're allowed to voice in your science class. And then if you really stick to the hard science of it, you can't have people saying, well, you're just some creationist warmed over, or we've got a separation of church and state issue in here. I really tell people that the hard science is really all you need to take on the Darwinists, because their own theories on their own turf are extremely flawed.
And what would you suggest for people about how they could go about doing that? I mean, how can we learn about the science? Because obviously we can't learn the science objectively necessarily in the classroom, because it just depends on what the school board is teaching. And, you know, you've written your book exposing the weakest link of Darwin's theory. I'm just put it that way. You know, you have your book, but where do people go to find good science to equip themselves to speak about this intelligently if they want to enter the fray?
Well, there are so many good writers in intelligent design. I would suggest if you wanted to align yourself with a whole cadre of people, the Discovery Institute in Seattle, Washington has all the big names in intelligent design go through there. It's an excellent website. You can also go to my website at www.ifse.org, and you will find, I think, really strong scientific arguments that you can take to those professors you were talking about and those hardline teachers and say, okay, I've got a science question, and it begs for an answer.
Yeah, that was always fun, talking to professors when I was in college. Good times. I almost miss those days.
I can tell you had some good stories.
Yeah, I sure did. You know, but I think that's one thing that I don't know how you feel about this, but a lot of Christians seem to lack is the courage to engage in this debate, because they feel like the evolutionists hold all the cards. You know, it often seems to be the case where we feel like, well, they have science on their side. What do I have on my side? I have my Sunday morning sermon. But that's really not the case. The cards are not all stacked against us. If anything, the cards are stacked for us. We just need to educate ourselves on exactly what science reveals and not assume that the evolutionists have it all sewn up.
Yeah, and I would echo what I said earlier. I truly, truly believe, to all your audience out there, that the more you try to be a strict Darwinist, the more you find yourself going against science, not with it. And I truly believe that.
Well, Kenneth Poppe, author of Exposing Darwinism's Weakest Link, Why Evolution Can't Explain Human Existence, thank you so much for sharing your time with us tonight. And one more time, tell everyone what your website is if they want to find out more about you and some of the work that you've been doing in this field.
You bet. Both my books are featured at www.ifsed.org. That's the International Foundation for Science Ed by Design. There's books, there's study guides, there's guest speakers available. I encourage your listeners to check us out.
Well, thank you so much for your time tonight, sir. I really do appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun discussing this with you, and I just can't thank you enough for taking some time out on a Sunday evening to talk with me.
You bet, yo. Great questions. Thank you.
All right. You have a great evening, sir.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye. Kenneth Poppe joining us tonight here on Raw Talk as we talk a little bit about evolution, intelligent design, and creationism. And one thing that I want to point out, you know, this is all a fascinating debate. It's absolutely interesting. I mean, I love this type of intelligent conversation. I love these types of issues. But let it not distract you from the core issue. More than anything else, we need to make sure that we're clearly relaying to people that they need a Savior to save them from their sins so that they can have forgiveness and eternal life. When we get into this debate too far, sometimes we forget that issue, And we don't want to forget that issue. It's fine if we can explain scientifically how we got here. The more important thing is, where are we going? And that's an issue that, unfortunately, sometimes is pushed to the sideline when we get super intense about this issue of intelligent design, evolution, and creationism. The Bible is very clear that we were made with a purpose to know a loving God who loved us so much that he sent his one and only son to die on the cross to pay the price for our sins that we couldn't pay so that we could have eternal life, forgiveness from everything that we've done wrong in our entire life, to have eternal freedom. And that, more than anything, is what humanity needs to know. That is humanity's number one need, is to know that they have an eternal destiny of life if they can accept the fact that Jesus Christ paid the price for them. And while all the science is very, very interesting, it's not going to answer that particular question. Where are you going to go when science is gone and life is over? Hopefully you have an answer to that question. If you don't, more than investigating the science of our origins, it's time to investigate the answers to what happens after life is over. And I hope you'll do that. I hope you'll look at places like John 14:6, John 3:16, if you'll just take a look at what the Bible says, starting even in Genesis in chapter 1, where it tells us that we were made in God's own image. That should tell you something right there. You're special. You're unique. You're made with a purpose. And if you'd like to talk more about that, send us an email, studio@m88.org, and we'd be happy to converse more about that with you. Now, hopefully next week we'll do a little bit of a follow-up on this. I'm trying to line up some people to talk about this with me. As we discuss, does the age of the Earth matter? That's what I'm trying to get in line for us next Sunday on Raw Talk, because it seems like that's another core issue to this, and it's also a fascinating subject in and of itself. Does the age of the Earth really matter? Who cares how old the Earth is? How does that affect us? We'll try and get some people on Raw Talk next Sunday to discuss that with us. And again, don't forget to get your tickets for the M88 prom coming this Friday. You can pick those up, Bibles Plus, Parchments, Chronicles, and Mr. Tux over on UBank. All the proceeds benefit M88. All the funds going to benefit you this Friday, Albuquerque Convention Center. All the details available at m88.com. org. Well, that's going to wrap things up for Raw Talk this evening. Thanks for hanging out with us, and hope you have a shway week in the Lord.